Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Special hello to everybody in Australia. Our guest this hour, just as last hour, is Trent Horn, the author of a whole bunch of books, including Answering Atheism and Why We're Catholic. And this hour is tips for defending the faith, but we're going to keep going with some of the calls. We didn't want to just hang up on people who called last hour, so we'll work our way through whatever calls come our way this hour. You're back, right, Trent? You're here with us?
You bet I am.
All right. You ready to take whatever comes our way?
Sure, even if something wicked this way comes. Is that Chaucer, I think?
Is that Chaucer? I thought that was Ibsen, but it could be. You might be right.
No, I always confuse that with Canterbury Tales. Oh no, Ray Bradbury. But he's probably quoting from something else. I'm sure by we get to the end of the next call.
Eventually, everything it goes back to the Bible. Something, you know, it's
right.
You go, oh, that guy's quoting that guy's. Yeah, but he got it from.
It's Macbeth. It's Macbeth. By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes. I always thought it was Canterbury.
Nice
Tales,
rhyme, Shakespeare. I could do a rhyme better than that. Oh my gosh! All right, now I know I'm a better writer than Shakespeare. Just realized, didn't know it before. The number 888-318-7884. Let's go to David in Maryland watching on YouTube. Glad to have you, David. Go ahead with your question, comment, whatever you got for Trent Horn.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And Trent Horn, before I begin, I want to thank you for sending me a copy of your books. I think one of my questions and one of the reasons for my atheism boils down to genetics. One of the key Catholic dogmas is original sin and that Adam was a real person. However, it seems like from what we know about genetics that Adam was not a real person and not all humans are descendants of Adam and Eve.
Right, okay. So this gets to a question that has been debated among theologians about we believe, as Catholics, we definitely believe in Adam and Eve and the fall of man. And traditionally, throughout church history, the understanding was that Adam and Eve, those terms corresponded to two individuals, the first human beings that existed, and in many cases were created directly from the dust of the earth, for example. Then, as modern evolutionary theory became the dominant scientific paradigm, Pope Pius XII, in an encyclical Humani Generis, I believe this was in 1950, published it. This was when we had what was called this new synthesis of evolution. This was taking Darwin's theory of evolution and combining it with discoveries in geology and genetics to form the synthesis of the evolutionary theory. And so Pope Pius XII released an encyclical Humani Generis, and in there he said that Catholics are free to believe that the human body evolved over time so that even Adam and Eve's bodies might have come from previous animals. So they might have had parents who did not have immortal souls but seemed similar to human beings. Now, your concern, David, seems to be, all right, even if that were the case, let's say you get Adam and Eve, they're from caveman parents who don't have immortal souls, and then, you know, they have, well, actually, this does go back a little bit. Let me bring it back together. Pius XII said you could believe man's body evolved over time. But there's a debate about monogenism, which is that Adam and Eve are two individuals, or polygenism, which is the idea that Adam and Eve are symbolic for groups of people, and so that it's symbolism that Adam and Eve represent a group of early humans thousands of years ago who fell away from God. Pope Pius XII said, basically, there did not seem to be any way, without outright condemning the proposition, he said there did not seem to be any way to reconcile the doctrine of original sin with Adam and Eve being groups of people that fell away from God. And so different theologians have proposed different solutions to the problem, but I don't think ultimately it is an intractable one. So there's different ones that you could pick from. One would just be God made Adam and Eve, even if he made them from the dust of the earth, and all human beings are descended from these two individuals, and modern genetics just cannot adequately reconstruct the past because of the unique genome that would have been present in the first humans Our science just can't really figure that out. And so it's, we know through faith, even if we can't see that through science. That's one option. And I'm just going to put the options on the table. People can pick which one they like the most. Another option would be the polygenism option, saying that they symbolize different people, and that what Pope Pius XII said, maybe there'll be some way to reconcile that view with the doctrine of original sin somehow. Then there's other hybrid views. One hybrid view that I find to be very interesting would be this, and it's one I kind of alluded to earlier. Adam and Eve were born of, we could call them, you know, Homo sapiens, right? Homo sapiens are human beings. We could call these Homo sapiens anatomicus, as in they look like you and me, they're human beings, but they don't have immortal souls. Adam is born, Eve is born, God selects these two people, gives them immortal souls, they become Homo sapiens theologicus. So they're like other human beings, but they have immortal souls. And so they have children, their offspring have immortal souls, their offspring then have relations with other Homo sapiens anatomicus that exist at the time. And their children possess souls. God creates from there. And so from that, you have a bunch of cavemen, whatever previous hominids that exist. Two of them were selected with immortal souls so that you have genetic continuity that science finds. But the dispersion of the immortal soul is something that science would not be able to discover. Some people don't like this view because they say it entails bestiality, that Adam and Eve's children are having relations with Homo sapiens and with creatures that don't have immortal souls. But I would say they would be almost virtually, at that stage of development, they would be almost virtually indistinguishable from one another. But I would say that the traditional view is not, also has unpleasant consequences, that all human beings, you know, that incest was how humanity first started. So it's kind of a pick your poison. I threw a lot out there, but I would just say that I do believe there are a variety of options for reconciling the science of genetics with Catholic origins. And because the Catechism speaks about the fall of man using non-literal language, I think that gives a lot of room to create a theological framework that makes faith and reason complementary here. So I hope it's a big topic you raised, but I hope that was a decent start.
Yeah, absolutely. Once again, thank you so much for the copies of your books. I will say that it's given me a new perspective on Jesus and a new perspective on the Catholic Church. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Anytime, David.
Beautiful
thank you
testimony.
So much.
Thank you, David.
Yes, I'm always happy to, people can always find me online, sending off books to people. If it can help somebody, I'm happy to do it. So,
that was a lovely call. All right. It's tips for defending the faith. I think we've got a few more atheists. So we're going to talk to you this hour, but if you want to call with any tip for defending the Catholic faith, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Trent Horn on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
This is Michael Drollman, Communications Director for Corpus Christi Broadcasting in Central Washington State. We rely on Catholic radio to send a gospel message to listeners in our area. We know people who have come into the church after listening to the excellent apologetics programming we provide. Catholic Radio, a great tool for evangelization.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn with us. Tips for defending the faith this hour. You're welcome to call with your questions. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Next, we go all the way over to Miami. Andrew in Miami watching on YouTube. We're glad to have you, Andrew. Go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Hello, Trent. Thank you for taking my call. Just wanted to ask, it's a if, but if James and Paul disagree with each other about justification, James 2 and Romans 4 or Galatians 2, if Paul and James disagree with each other on it, when Abraham was justified, what does that do to the inerrancy of Scripture? And can you still be a Catholic?
Yeah. So what I would say, and there's a lot that can be brought up here. So when we have in Romans chapter 4, Paul is talking about being justified by faith. And so, you know, he's talking let's bring up Romans 4, actually. That can help us with our discussion.
The RSVCE version, please.
RSVCE.
I'm very attached to that version.
Yes. So in Romans 4, it talks about Abraham being his faith. Faith was reckoned to Abraham as righteousness before or after he had been circumcised. He received circumcision as a sign or seal of righteousness he had by faith while still being uncircumcised. So Paul's dispute here in Romans is about what do you need to do to be justified before God? And there were a lot of Jews at the time who were saying, yeah, we believe Jesus is the Messiah, but to be right with God, to become a good Christian, you got to be a good Jew first in order to be justified before God. And so Paul is saying, no, we're justified by faith. We can receive Christ through faith. We don't need to be circumcised first, because Abraham wasn't circumcised. He was justified when he believed God's promises and left Ur of the Chaldees. But that's not a contradiction with James 2. And I think the Catholic view is helpful here, although there are other Protestants who would affirm this view as well. The new perspective on Paul from N.T. Wright or James Dunn would also affirm a lot of the points here in the Catholic view. And there are other Anglicans and other Protestants who would affirm this, that justification is not, if justification were a single moment that happens once in your life, then we'd have a contradiction here in Scripture if Abraham is justified before he is circumcised and justified after, when he offers Abraham on the altar Isaac. As a sacrifice. When Abraham offers Isaac in James chapter 2, because that's separated by decades. If it's one moment and we have two moments in being justified, we'd have a contradiction. The way around the contradiction, I would say, is to see that justification is not a single moment. Justification is a process. And so Paul and James in the New Testament teaches that justification begins in a moment by faith. And Paul would move from Romans 4 to then talk in Romans 6 about how that moment for Christians is baptism. Baptism in Romans 6 makes it clear we die with Christ, we rise with him. And so we, by faith, we receive baptism either for ourselves or for our children. And then we are united to Christ. But when we do good deeds, when we do good works, God's grace is what allows us to increase our justification or increase our righteousness before God. And so Abraham's righteousness increases. It doesn't get him saved before God, but it increases that righteousness he had previously received. So I think that there's no contradiction here if you see that justification is not a single moment, but it is a process. And these are two different things that are being discussed. So I tell you what, Andrew, I would like to send you a copy. Let's get your email address, and I will send you a copy of my book, The Case for Catholicism. It's a very in-depth treatment of Protestant objections to Catholicism. It talks about justification in a more in-depth way. In chapter 11 of the book, I talk about comparing Paul's, well, actually chapter 10, I talk about James, and in chapter 11, I talk about Paul, and I show how they're not contradictory. So I'd love to send you a copy of The Case for Catholicism. You can check that out. Actually, let's send you that, and then let's send you Hard Sayings, because I talk about biblical inerrancy, and I define that term because of other alleged contradictions that are in Scripture. So we'll send you Case for Catholicism and Hard Sayings, and I pray that that is helpful for you.
Thanks, Andrew. The number is 888-318-7884. Tips for Defending the Faith this hour with Trent Horn. You got something that you need some help defending about the Catholic faith, or that you need defended, then you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Let's go to Kevin in Kentucky watching on YouTube. Kevin, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi, Cy and Trent. I'm a big fan of both of yours, and I'm very grateful that you took my question.
Well, thank you.
In case context helps, I am ex-Catholic and currently agnostic atheist.
Okay.
So the majority of scholars seem to accept that the Gospel of Mark is the oldest of the Gospels. They also seem to accept that the ending of Mark is not original. Jesus dies, the women find the tomb empty, they leave, they tell nobody. End scene. The epistles, of course, are older than the Gospels, but Paul never saw Jesus in the flesh. This seems to suggest a legendary attribute to the books of the Bible, where they become more fantastic over time. This is certainly not a knockdown argument for atheism, but
sure.
In some sort of Bayesian context, it does seem to count in favor of atheism, or at least agnosticism regarding the divinity of Jesus. So I'm just interested
did
to
you
hear
say,
your thoughts.
Did you say a Bayesian context?
Yeah.
Yes.
Not,
well, we won't. It's what we would call an I would say it's what we would call an undercutting defeater rather than a rebutting defeater. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you could also cash it out in terms related to Bayes' theorem that that Paul's testimony being early and Mark's testimony being early, some might argue this is more probable on the hypothesis that Jesus did not rise from the dead than that he did. But I don't consider that to be the case for several reasons. To say, oh, well, look, Paul never met the Jesus prior to his ascension into heaven, and Mark is the earliest gospel, but part of the ending of has been added on later. Let me take both of those claims. First, in Mark 16, I would say your description is a bit truncated. The women go to the tomb. Jesus is not there. There is a young man sitting there dressed in a white robe, which is usually imagery that alludes to an angel. And he says to them, "Do not be amazed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. Go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him as he told you." So I think that Mark's, then there's verse 8. We'll get to that in a second. But I think that's very clear. Mark is affirming that Jesus died, was buried, and that his tomb was empty, and that Jesus rose from the dead, and that Jesus appeared to other disciples, and in particular, Peter. It's interesting that Peter is singled out here because this coheres with Luke's testimony and Paul's testimony that one of the particular appearances of the risen Jesus was to Peter as an individual, as well as to the disciples as a whole. He's going before you to Galilee. There you will see him as he told you. So I would say Mark is evidence of resurrection appearances. The appearances are not legends added later. Also, Paul is the earliest witness. You're right. But Paul talks about even other appearances. He talks about appearances to the 500, to James. Paul has a lot of appearances. He's very early. But I would say, you know, if the legendary hypothesis is true, we'd have lots more appearances in the other Gospels. Paul writing early, and Paul knows Peter and James. He says, "I have met the other apostles. I met Peter and James, the brother of the Lord, or the relative of the Lord." So I think that counts against the legend hypothesis. As for that they didn't tell anybody, in Mark 16:8 it says, "They went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had come upon them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid." And then it goes on, verses 9 through 20. It talks about the appearance of Mary Magdalene, two disciples, Jesus appearing to the disciples, the ascension. You're correct. Verses 9 through 20 are not in the earliest manuscripts of Mark's gospel. A lot of scholars believe that ending was added later. And there are a few hypotheses behind that. One would be that this ending is Mark's original ending. It was just lost from some manuscripts and then added. Not a lot of people endorse that because of differences in language and things like that. Others might say that a disciple of Mark or someone in the Christian community filled in these historical gaps. Though it could have been something that was, there is evidence pointing towards that it has a Markan origin, because we wouldn't be surprised if Mark had, that this is essentially what Mark wrote or something similar, but that part was lost because it's the end of the scroll and it's easy for it to get torn off. And so someone was able to recreate faithfully what Mark had originally written. And then finally, it could be the case Mark had kind of an avant-garde ending, and he purposely did end it at verse 8, but he didn't mean to intend that there was no resurrection appearance or that the women literally didn't tell anybody. I like to compare Mark 16:8 to Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So it's like when Charlie finds the golden ticket And the guy at the candy store is like, run home, Charlie. Don't tell anybody, because everyone's trying to get the golden ticket. And he runs home and he, you know, don't tell anyone. And Charlie ran home and he told no one, for he was afraid. Well, clearly Charlie did tell people. He told his grandparents and he went to the factory and all that. What Mark means here is that the women were scared about what happened, so they told no one along the way. And so then they told others, and we get the account. What I meant by avant-garde, one last thing, is that there is a possibility also that Mark ended it here, that the women didn't tell anyone. So who are you going to tell? If they didn't tell anyone on the way, what are you going to do now? Well, that's what I mean by avant-garde. Now, I threw a lot out at you from looking at those two things, the legendary hypothesis. I didn't mean to bury you in a reply, but is that at least a helpful start?
Yes, very. Yeah, you've given me a lot of homework.
Sure. Okay. And actually, some of the stuff you brought up is similar to what John Steingard, who is a former Christian who's from the Christian band Hawk Nelson, who's now non-Christian, we talked about in my episode today on the Council of Trent podcast. You might benefit from listening. It was a two-hour conversation with him. Some of the points, I think, at least on the New Testament, I resonate with you that John brought up. So definitely check that out. And then if you like, let's get your email address. If you can send us your email, I'd be happy to send you a copy of my book, Counterfeit Christs, that goes into more detail about the arguments for and against the person of Jesus. So just stay on the line. We'll get your email and we'll do that.
Yep. There you go. Okay. Kevin, thank you very, very much. Trent Horn is our guest. Tips for defending the faith this hour. If you'd like some help defending some aspect of the faith or explaining some aspect of the faith, 888-318-7884. Felix in Indianapolis, listening on 89.1 FM. You are up next. Felix, go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi, Trent. Appreciate you taking the call. I've definitely read a lot of your books, and you've spent many hours in my head while I'm running listening to podcasts, so I really appreciate all your work.
Sure, thank you.
And appreciate you. And my question for you is that I am a high school counselor, and as you can imagine, I deal with a lot of issues that kind of cut against the grain in terms of Catholic teaching and just Christianity in general. So
yeah, sure.
I'm looking for any advice or suggestions that you have about how to evangelize in an area where I am a public servant, and there's so much that I can speak on, but I also want to openly share my faith with others.
Yeah, that's hard and it's also hard because as a public school teacher, it can seem kind of like a double standard that there are atheists. I think maybe, and it depends what climate you're in. I would just say if you notice other teachers who let their personal beliefs be on their sleeves, follow what others have done and keep receipts, like keep evidence of what other teachers have done. So like if there is an atheistic teacher or a Protestant teacher who puts personal items on their desk that is a signal of their personal beliefs, or they post on social media things that they believe, feel free that if you want to share your faith in those similar ways, just always have receipts ready. If someone at school says, hey, I noticed you're doing this, you know, you can't be promoting your faith. And you say, well, you know, I wear my little baby feet pin, or I do have my crucifix on my desk. So-and-so does this and so-and-so does that. If you can do that, then they can say, oh, you know, you got to treat us all equally. Either we all can share our personal views or not. But you do have to be careful that in working in a public school, you can't be seen as endorsing one particular faith over another or proselytizing. But there are some things you can do. So one thing I think can be helpful is making yourself available to Christian, especially to Catholic student groups. If there isn't one, a Christian group, but hopefully there's a Catholic group. If you know Catholic students, well, I guess I could ask you that, Felix. Is there a Catholic club on your campus?
There is not, and there's not a Christian club. We used to have a prayer group, and it's kind of sad because we do have a very large public high school that I work at. One thing I have done, actually two things. I've started a staff kind of prayer group. It's pretty small right now, but just to talk about Christianity prior to school starting, of course, with some other staff members. And then I was also a high school catechist for a few years. And my fear with continuing on with that, as like gender dysphoria becomes a bigger issue, I'm concerned that some of the things from that class will come back and bite me in the butt at work, if you know what I'm saying. Like, I'm never going to do anything that I feel is morally wrong.
Right. But I would say this, if you're teaching a catechism class at your church, that the school, if they were to reprimand you for something you did at church in your capacity as a private individual, not representing the school, that was, I would say, would actually be unconstitutional for them to do that, just as it would be wrong for them to fire a Jewish teacher for going to Shabbat on Friday, or a Muslim teacher who refuses to eat pork. But Felix, actually, please stay on the line. I do have a good idea for you that I hope you and other listeners in a similar position, I want you to consider. So stay on the line. I'll give you an idea and we'll come back.
Okay, hang on, Felix. We'll be right back with more Tips for Defending the Faith with Trent Horn.
This is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Thank you for listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, Healing the Wound.
Going through a difficult time, struggling to heal past hurts, will help you find the answers you're seeking and God's presence in the midst of the pain.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Trent Horn is our guest. Tips for Defending the Faith right now. I think our current caller who's on the line with us, Felix in Indianapolis, with a question about, you know, what can I do as a teacher, has spawned a possible future program, because there's a very good kind of civil rights, religious rights lawyer here in San Diego that we could get to do the show. And maybe we could just do this just for teachers. Like, what can I do in the public space? What can I say no to? Like, I don't know about the pronouns. Like, if you work in a public school, are by law, do you have to do the pronouns, or can you not do the pronouns? And you know what's funny? Everybody knows exactly what I'm talking about. If I just say right. Do the pronouns, everybody, there's nobody that doesn't know what that's about. Ask Dave Chappelle. He knows what I'm talking about. Let's go back to Trent's answer for Felix.
Yeah. So Felix, are you still there?
Yes, and I did just want to add that based on, you know, so I just mentioned the pronouns, we, as a counselor, I am encouraged to, like, I'm supposed to use preferred pronouns, although I kind of get around that in a way by just going with name every time. And with the confirmation class, my concern was that because a lot of my students from my school feed into that confirmation class, that's where it seemed like there might be the concern with administration to where if I was saying something that went against, like, a school rule in that setting.
But I would say here is if you're in a confirmation class articulating principles of the Catholic faith, and you're doing it at the church and not at not at school, then they and you're not using school materials, you're not using your presence as a public school teacher to advocate the message, you're a catechist teacher at your church, I don't see how they could have any grounds. Otherwise, that would be a clear infringement on your freedom of religion to be able to practice your faith. So here's what I recommend. Two things. One, for your position or any teacher or faculty member at a public school, see if there is a Catholic club on your campus. I became Catholic through a Catholic Life Teen club. So see if there's a Catholic club. You can contact Life Teen to get resources on that. One way you could do that would be to reach out, just send an email, find the local Catholic churches around your high school, go to the parish website and find the youth minister or the religious educator, the person who does religious education or youth minister, send them an email. Their email is going to be on the website. Say, hey, I teach at this public school. We don't have a Catholic club. I would love to sponsor a club, because one of the hardest things to do if you're a student and you want to start a Catholic club on your campus, usually you have to have a faculty sponsor. And a lot of faculty sponsors, if they're not Catholic, they don't want to have anything to do with it. But if you are faculty and say, hey, I'll be happy to help, a lot of students might not know you want to do that. So you can let the youth ministers know, hey, I would love to sponsor a Catholic club if you ever want to start it at my school. The youth minister talks to the high school students in his youth group, who say, yeah, we want to do this, then the students go to you, ask you to be the sponsor of the club, and right there, you got a Catholic club that meets at lunch, and that's a great opportunity to evangelize people. Another tip I've seen is public school teachers sometimes debate ethical issues. I've been invited into public schools to debate abortion, and here's what they do. The public school teacher who is Catholic invites Planned Parenthood on day one to give the pro-choice view. And then I come in on day two to give the pro-life view and clean up everything the Planned Parenthood rep did. Because there you can say, hey, I wanted to teach about an important ethical social issue. I had both sides come in. I gave them equal time. And then you're not favoring one side or the other. And you got to keep your comments to yourself to not favor one side or the other, even though I bet a lot of other liberal teachers probably wouldn't do that. You need to do that. But you can say, hey, I had both sides equal time. Pro-choice people came Monday, the pro-life guy came Tuesday, and the students could hear from both. That's another neat way to, or on any issue, I think that can be helpful. So Felix, hope that was a help for you, I'd recommend. And yeah, definitely, I hope you have a very good day. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Felix. Thanks very much. I think we've got an idea for a future show. You're kind of like gentle as a lamb or as a dove and clever as a serpent there, Trent.
Matthew 10:16, baby. It's the way to do it. You got to be shrewd. Shrewd is the optimal word here. And I guess my response is always, who, me? No, you
no,
think I was?
I would
you
never
think
do
I was,
that.
I did, you think I did all this just so that the students would see a great pro-life presentation? Nah.
No.
Wink. No,
you got to confuse with somebody. Ryan in Ontario. I know of two Ontarios. I'm just telling you this, Thomas. There's one in Canada. And there's one in California. And I don't know which Ontario I'm going to. And I need to know if I'm speaking to a Canadian. I believe this is information we need. Before you get on the phone with a Canadian, you want to know that they're Canadian. Hi, Ryan. Which Ontario are you in?
Yeah, I'm Canadian.
Yeah, I could tell from the word yeah, I could tell you were Canadian. Okay, Ryan, we're glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm a big fan of you and Trent. So I'm an 18-year-old teen, and I'm kind of learning apologetics, and I was wondering, you know, how to get into the apologetic space, and I'm kind of a beginner, and yeah. I was kind of wondering, you know, how do I get into that? Like, do I start reading books? Do I, like, take courses? And my second kind of add-on question is, you know, I have a lot of friends who are kind of fading away from the faith. And so I was wondering, how do I kind of be an influence to them to kind of, you know, come back and kind of explain to them, you know, like Jesus, the truth. And like, they already know that, but I kind of want to, you know, be more of an influence. So how do I kind of explain, you know, the faith to them in that way?
Yeah. And Ryan, this is awesome, by the way. If you're starting with, and this is really, I mean, I started with apologetics probably when I was about 16, because I had to go through it all during my conversion experience. I think you're in a great place to really learn deeply about your faith to benefit yourself and others. The first caveat, though, I would say is don't confuse apologetics with the faith. Arguments for the faith are not the same thing as the faith. So always be rooted in the sacraments and be rooted in prayer. If you spend all your time on apologetics, spiritually, it's not going to be good for you. Go to Mass, go to confession, go to adoration, surround yourself with good Catholic friends, make sure you have that foundation, and then start wading into apologetics. And it's number two, don't be overwhelmed. There's a lot of stuff you could learn, spend your whole lifetime learning. Don't be overwhelmed. Start small and you can make a big difference. Here are the resources I would recommend for you to start. Every day, read one chapter of the New Testament and 10 paragraphs of the Catechism. So that should take you about 10 minutes. Just read the New Testament and the Catechism of the Catholic Church. If you know the faith, 80% of apologetics is just correcting misunderstandings people have. So right there, that's an easy one. One chapter in the New Testament, 10 paragraphs of the Catechism. If you do that Monday through Friday, take a break on the weekends, you'll have it done in 1 year. If you read faster than that, that's great. New Testament, Catechism. Know that very well. When it comes to books to start you on apologetics, I'm going to recommend two that I will send you as a free gift. One is Why We're Catholic, the book that I wrote. It's a nice summary of the faith, a good apologetic, a nice start for you. The other is a book called A Daily Defense by my friend Jimmy Akin. And that's you read one page a day, and in 1 year, you get like 366, including the leap year day, 366 little apologetic nuggets. You just start small with these things. We'll send you a copy of Daily Defense and Why We're Catholic. And then if you want another foundation, I would recommend our Catholic Answers School of Apologetics, which is at schoolofapologetics.com. But it's just a lot of reading and growing, and it just takes time and practicing dialogue with people and willing to suffer being kind of rusty at it until you get more of the facts and arguments under your fingers. So don't always be rooted in Christ, rooted in the sacraments and a good community. Start small, New Testament catechism, read the books that I'll send, and just grow day by day at it, and you got plenty of time. So is that a helpful start?
Yeah, the funny thing is I actually just ordered your book, Why We're Catholic, on Amazon like an hour ago because I kind of got inspired as I was watching the podcast. I just came to my mind.
We'll send you a free copy and then use the copy you ordered to give to someone that if you have a good conversation with them and you feel like they're open to Catholicism or coming back to the church, give them that copy you ordered and you can keep the free one, the free electronic one that we'll send to you. Well, did you order a physical one or an electronic one?
Yeah, it's a physical one.
Oh, great. Then give that one to someone and as a way to evangelize, and we'll send you one that you can keep for yourself.
All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ryan.
No problem, sir. Thank you very much.
We'll probably take a break right now, and we'll be right back with more tips for defending the faith. There's a couple of lines open. We'll do our very best to get to everybody. 888-318-7884. Trent Horn, our guest, right back after this.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
The Church has 2,000 years of wisdom to share on what it takes to live life gracefully.
We're so overwhelmed by how much our faith has transformed our marriage and family especially. We want everyone to experience the incredible gift that the Catholic vision of life and love really is.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchak. Tomorrow morning, 10 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I can't even believe that I'm about to say this, but we got another conference coming up. It's just right around the corner, September 22nd through the 25th in the year 2022. But it's already on sale, and so we wanted to tell you that the early bird pricing is happening now. You just enter promo code EARLY for $50 off. All of our guys will be there. We'll do the show live a couple times. Father Hugh Barber's going to be making his return to the conference, and we also have Bishop Paprocki coming to be the, I believe he's the keynote speaker. I'm not sure, Bishop Thomas Paprocki from Springfield, Illinois, great canon lawyer. But the main thing is, lo, I am with you always. The Eucharist, sacrifice, real presence, communion. That's the theme. The one thing we need to talk about, the one thing it will do us probably the most spiritual good to talk about, the Eucharist. We are a Eucharistic church. So if you want to come, just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. If you just want to find out about it, CatholicAnswersConference.com. If you just want to look at pictures of Trent Horn, CatholicAnswersConference.com. James in South Carolina is next, listening on 7:30 a.m. Hi, James. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Very well, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. First time I ever called, I got through. It's pretty cool.
Nice. We usually try to make you call a bunch of times before we let you through, but I'm glad you got through the first time.
Yeah, that's good. I'm not a Catholic. I respect the Catholic faith a whole lot. I love the Catholic Church. I'm from the evangelical movement. The question I have that just confuses me is, because I don't think we think that much different, is salvation, to be saved, do you have to, is works required for salvation or no? According to the Catholic Church.
Sure. And I guess, my question would be, and this might be your question as well. What do you mean by the word works?
Well, that's what I don't understand. Well, the way I see it, the way that I've been taught and the way I've interpreted the Bible is Jesus Christ died for us on the cross. So he died for my sins, and his death on the cross was sufficient for me, for us, for those who accept him as our Savior. And so if I add to that, if I say say for Islam, I'm not knocking Islam, but just say for Islam, they have to pray five times a day towards Mecca, I believe, in order to be saved. You know, and so my understanding of Jesus Christ and the Christian faith is we don't have to do that kind of stuff because Christ died for us. Now, every faithful Christian I know does good works. I mean, we do bad things too sometimes. I mean, we're all sinners. But, I mean, every Christian I know is striving to do good works. And so that's where the confusion is, because we're all striving to do good works, but does the Catholic Church actually teach it is actually by some kind of works that you've done that you're saved?
Right. Well, let me read what the Catechism of the Catholic Church says. Well, let me clear up misconceptions, read the Catechism. We can also talk a little bit about what we mean by the word works, because we really need to define that term. For example, if by works you mean doing something that of our own human ability that requires God to give us salvation, then under that term, no human work is capable of bringing us salvation. But if by work you just mean, if a work is, like a good work, is something you do that pleases God, then if we drop that in there, it seems to change the equation, right? Like if I said this, in order to be saved, let me ask you this question. In order to be saved, do you have to do something? What do you think of that question?
And I mean, honestly, in order to be, I would know that I was not saved if I was constantly not doing something. If I was constantly living in sin, repetitively,
let me give you this example. Do you need to believe in Jesus?
Yes, of course.
So I would say that making an act of faith is doing something that pleases God. So you could almost define faith as a kind of work, right?
Right. True. Yeah, I agree with
So I think there's two different kinds of works. There are works that only come from us. Those can't save us. But if we do a work that cooperates with God's grace, where we do something that cooperates with the grace of God, then we aren't adding anything to salvation. We are cooperating with the free gift of grace God gives us. And I think we could agree, well, you do have to do something. Like, not all Christians will agree with this. Some will say, hey, you don't do anything. Even the faith, God's doing that through you. You're not really doing it. But I think a lot of us would say, no, I either choose to believe in Jesus or I choose to reject Jesus. So I'm going to believe in him. That's doing something. So here's what the Catechism says in paragraph 2010. And let me preface this by saying we believe salvation is not a moment. It is a process. So salvation is something that begins in our life. It continues through our whole life. And then salvation ends when we get to heaven. So it is a process.
Right.
The beginning of the process, there is no work you can do to begin your salvation. There's absolutely nothing you can do. Paragraph 2010 of the Catechism says, since the initiative belongs to God and the order of grace, no one can merit the initial grace of forgiveness and justification at the beginning of conversion. So think about a baby who's baptized. So when a baby is baptized, that baby is saved, but he did absolutely nothing. He didn't even make an act of faith. It was made by his parents. But we believe that baby is saved, and he did absolutely nothing. He is saved in baptism. When you are baptized, you receive the gift of baptism through faith, either your parents or yourself. I was baptized as a teenager. So in doing that, there's no work you do. You receive it through faith. But then after baptism, to remain in God's grace, there is only one work we must do for the rest of our life. And that work is this: do not remain separated from God until death. Because we would say, hey, you're saved, you're baptized, you're a Christian, you're regenerated, but you could choose to fall away. You could reject the faith. You could become an atheist, or you could reject the faith in your actions by committing a grave evil. And if you choose to never be reconciled with God and you die, then you'll be apart from him for all eternity. So the only work then after being baptized one must do to be saved is to not remain in the state that is called mortal sin, which is committing a grave evil that separates us from God's love, usually a violation of one of the Ten Commandments, or related to the Ten Commandments. Do not remain in that state until death. So keep God's moral law. If you break it, be reconciled to God. And that's why God gave us the sacrament of confession. So there's other things that are tied in with that. But the works that we do, they do nothing to earn. God does not have to give us salvation. We are his adopted children. But we can choose to tell God, like the prodigal son, I'm done with you, I'm out of here, and foolishly walk away. The question is, will we come back to God and be reconciled? But I will say the good works, like prayers, devotions, feeding the hungry, corporal works of mercy, things like that, those do not save us per se, but they increase our righteousness and they make our souls stronger so that we're less likely to commit a grave or mortal sin and walk away from God. But if you like, I would like to send you, James, two books. One would be my book, Why We're Catholic, which has a whole chapter on salvation. And another book by my friend Jimmy Akin called The Drama of Salvation, which is a whole in-depth look at faith and works and everything related to that. So stay on the line and give us your contact information, and we can send that to you. But is that a helpful start?
Yeah, that was a great explanation. One more little question.
Sure.
Like, so if you don't get baptized and you die, you're going to hell, according to the Catholic Church?
Paragraph 1257 of the Catechism says that God has bound salvation to the sacrament of baptism, but God is not bound by the sacraments. So that is the ordinary means God has given. If someone goes to heaven, it's because God chose an extraordinary way to save them. So God is all powerful, and he can give his grace to anybody he wants at any time. He's God. He has that choice to do that. But this is the ordinary means he gave us, being baptized. But if you're not baptized for some reason outside of your control, you died before you had the chance to get baptized, whether you were in the womb or a baby or, you know, something else, God could choose to give you grace that you would have received when you're baptized. In the church's history, catechumens, people who said, I want to be baptized, and then they died before baptism. They were buried on church property and presumed to be in heaven because it was assumed that God would grant them a baptism of desire. So is that a helpful answer to that follow-up?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much the same thing I've always been taught. It's very similar, like the works also. So I like sure. A little very minor difference. I actually probably do believe you can probably walk away from God, where most people I know, a lot of people I know don't believe that. But I mean, it's so minuscule. It's like, it's not that big a deal.
So anywho, James, let's send you those books. Give us your contact info, and I'm very grateful you called. So thanks for calling us.
Thanks, James. What a very, very, very nice call. Let's go to Joshua in Virginia watching on YouTube. Joshua, you're going to have to be a little bit quick. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. I have a question regarding a pro-choice argument.
Okay.
So the argument is this. Premise one, it is morally permissible to remove a clone from your body. Premise two, if so, then it's morally permissible to get an abortion. Conclusion, so it's morally permissible to get an abortion. So one objection that in the article he refutes is where pregnancy from sex is natural. He says this, and the fact that something's natural is also morally irrelevant, and to assume otherwise is a fallacious appeal to nature. So.
Oh, okay, Joshua. We might run out of time here. What article is this from, actually?
It's one from a social media. TikTok.
So is he saying, like, if he's... There. Oh, okay. So it's not like a... philosopher. That's a little disappointing. But the idea is that you make a clone. So you take one of my cells and you make like a fetus or embryo and put it in my body. I'd have the right to remove it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And what I would say there is, yeah, I do think that there is a difference, that pregnancy is a result of engaging in an act you know will create needy people. The clone example is nothing like that. I also do think that what he's saying is the naturalistic fallacy. That's not the case. Some of our body organs are designed for only our body. Some are designed for other people. If someone put a clone in my abdomen, you know, my stomach and abdomen, it's only made just for me, not for another human being. But a woman's reproductive organs, like if her baby is starving and she has milk to nurse the baby, that those organs in her body are naturally designed to sustain that child's life. And so she has an obligation to use those organs to care for the child, especially since in nearly every case, she engaged in an act that made that child. And I would say the same is true for the uterus and other organs that sustain a child before birth. I've covered similar arguments in my book, Persuasive Pro-Life. I would definitely recommend that if you want to go deeper in the subject. But I always love little fascinating thought experiments. You never know what people will come up with, but thanks for calling in.
That one wasn't entirely clear to me, though, because I mean, first of all, I don't think there are any human clones right
yeah
now.
it's definitely it's a science fiction example, let me give you you could make it realistic. What if someone implanted an embryo in your body, in a man's body? Would he be justified in removing that embryo? It doesn't have to be a clone. It's just if you put an embryo in a
An embryo can't do anything in a man's body. It has nothing to nourish it. I mean, unless they...
It could continue to grow like some ectopic pregnancies. But I would say there, a man would not be... it could be an extraordinary case to remove the damaged tissue where this embryo is. So it's a principle of double effect, like removing an ectopic pregnancy. And it would not be comparable to abortion. But if you wanted to allow the child to try to grow and survive... he could morally choose to do that.
That would certainly be a morally excellent thing to do.
It would be heroic or supererogatory.
Supererogatory. Well, I didn't know you were going to start swearing here right at the end. Trent Horn has been our guest. You can find him at TrentHornPodcast.com. That's the Council of Trent, and lots of people have, and they're happy they did. Thanks very much, Trent. Really appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Si.
You gave away 1 million books today. 1 million books. See you tomorrow. 2 hours of open forum. Father Hugh Barber, right here, Catholic Answers Live.